Session number 26947.
Mr. Jarvis, Reel 5. We're talking about your time at the number 4 British Flying Training School in Phoenix. What about the conditions generally? We've talked about Lee, but what were conditions actually like on the base, your accommodation and food and things?
Well, we had single-storey premises, long dormitories. They comprised with something like about 20 cadets in each dormitory, a mixture of American and RAF cadets, which was an excellent arrangement, actually. But the conditions were was superb. There's no other way to describe it. And the food was food which we hadn't seen for about 4 years. You had eggs, bacon, steak, anything, really unlimited food. It was extremely rich. And one couldn't possibly afford it. The only strange thing was the Americans have a habit of having all their food in one dish in various segments. And it does seem strange to have your soup in one segment and your sweet in the other with custard sort of thing. But however, one got used to that sort of thing, obviously, yes. But the beds were good. We had cabinets and everything was extremely comfortable, kept to a very high standard by Mexican ladies who actually cleaned the dormitories. And it was quite peculiar, really, because they had no inhibitions in the lavatories, which kept in wonderful condition. When they've been used by the cadets, they'll go in and sweep round their feet while they're probably maybe using the toilet with no inhibitions at all. It was most extraordinary. And then English cadets, obviously, were basically quite reserved, and it came hard at first, but we got used to it.
Were they treated well, the Mexican servants? Pretty well paid, or
no? I don't think they're desperately well paid, but they seemed to be happy doing their work. They were thoroughly nice people.
The cadets were treated them all right.
Oh, they did. Yes, yes.
Would you get you talked about your local leave in between courses in Hollywood.
Hollywood.
What
yeah.
about? On an evening, would you be able to go into Phoenix? You said it was reasonably close, but
about 20 miles away. We wouldn't go during the evening because generally we had homework to do. Related to our ground school subjects. But we used to, at weekends, we had the whole of Saturday and Sunday off, and we went to what was called the British War Relief Association. It was a large building in Phoenix that had been purchased and used for the use of our RAF cadets. It was run by an organisation called the Daughters of the British Empire. And there were women who had some connection with this country. Either they were brought up here, or they had ancestors that came from England or the British Isles. But they were very pro-British and kindness itself, to say the least of it.
Now, what did they put on? This was a building that the association
that's right.
ran.
That's where we stayed during the course of the weekend. We had living accommodation there, beds, etc. And then that they arranged for all sorts of social activities. A lot of the families, American families, took us into their homes. We spent the weekends with them at times. And they were kindness itself. I think that's the only expression I can really use.
Okay, so at the end of the course, was there a final assessment, or how was it? What happened at the end of the six
well,
months?
Well, having the 6 months, you then had what was known as your wings examination. Now, that comprised the flying side and the ground school side, and obviously quite different aspects. But they were all the marks were gathered together, and if you were successful in both, then naturally you graduated, and you got your wings.
Now, which, how did you find the examinations? Was it a tough call?
The last one were very comprehensive. And especially the flying side, you had to go with chief flying instructors and demonstrate to them the extremes of your training, and it was quite severe. But
did you fear failure, or were you confident?
I personally was always confident. And again, going back to my earlier life, it's strange, really. I was very dedicated. I really wanted to get my wings, as with most of them did, obviously, yeah. But and as a result, I tend to develop a confidence that just carried me through right to the end. And with regard to my positions in examination, I was 37th out of 107. Now, that might surprise you, the figure, but the only reason why we had 107, because one flying school closed down in Texas, and their cadets were allocated to our course, and so therefore we were ended up with about 107, an amalgamation of two schools. And out of the 100, I was 37th out of 107, which wasn't bad. There were about 70 pilots who were below me, and I was number 20 in the flying, and out of 107, which was considered to be an above average grading. Yeah.
So you got your wings and qualified as a sergeant pilot.
That's right.
Now, would the top
those ones up there? They're the very ones.
That this was... is in a, on display on the windowsill. Now, yeah. Would if you'd got higher in the top five or six, would you have qualified as an officer or been
no.
sent to opt to, or was this just you were automatically going to be?
You were either going to be a sergeant or an officer. Now, the question of the, who decided who was going to be the officer, in each school, it was the commanding officer. And there were very people who became officers. I'm afraid they were very, very lowly as far as examinations were concerned, strange it may seem. One pilot officer that I knew, he was 106th out of 107 in ground school, and but he still got a commission.
Well, based on what? I mean, how did they select them?
Well, at our particular school, the commanding officer seemed to have a great favour towards people who were mature, elderly, in relation to the young cadets, we 18, 19-year-olds, and also people that had been ex-policemen and had joined aircrew, and finally those that had been on the ground staff and had remustered to go into aircrew. Those three categories broadly were the ones that they selected, the 10% of us that were that would become pilot officers.
So all those things were based on indicated a maturity, policemen, old people, older people, not
yeah.
old.
Older, oh yes, I quite agree.
Ex-ground crew, but they all indicate they'd be older.
They were older than absolutely. That appeared to be the yardstick that we were measured
so
by.
So it wasn't a form of class prejudice. He wasn't just picking the public school boys or the,
oh, no,
or
no.
the grammar school boys as well.
Oh, no, no.
He just, that was his thing.
That is quite true. See, with regard to the educational standards of the cadets, those who I trained with, in the main, were either grammar school boys or had come for universities, but there were very few, probably less than half a dozen, like myself, who actually came from elementary school, which was unusual, you know, to have them at that particular grade, so or that standard of education. But it was obviously sufficient that your education to take you through. Yeah.
They didn't look down on you at all. Though.
Not at all. No, no, no. We're all the same.
So when did you get your wings? I don't know whether you know the date.
I do.
The date.
Yeah. It was the 17th of June, 1944.
And. What happened then? You finished the course.
Yes. Then we were returned to Moncton in Canada. 5.5 days in the train, again the reverse direction, and stayed in Moncton for a couple of weeks whilst we were waiting a ship to return to the UK. I returned on the Empress of Scotland, which was hitherto, by the way, known as the Empress of Japan, but for obvious reason, the name was changed. Yes, and when we came home again, totally unescorted, came back to this country to Gerak, the place from which we departed.
And that'd be in July, I presume.
It would be in July.
Do you remember anything about the voyage on the Empress of Scotland? I mean,
Very, very little. Very little. It was quite uneventful. Yeah.
Was the ship crowded? I mean, it was the
Oh
return.
yes, much more than when we went over. There were mostly trained air crew had come from many, many schools in Canada, apart from the handful of schools in America. Yeah. And there were quite a lot. There probably were maybe a couple of thousand, something to that order, yeah. But there were quite a lot. And
Was it uncomfortable or?
No, I still remember being in cabins. So we were never in hammocks. There were a lot of troop ships, yeah. But no, we had a very gentlemanly voyages on both sides.
Now what happened when you got back to Gourock?
Well, then we were sent to Harrogate, which was the overseas aircrew receiving centre. People that obviously are returning not only from Canada, from America, but also for South Africa and Rhodesia, that are the other places where crew were trained during the war.
And what happened there? What was the purpose of that? I mean,
you're in a holding situation, and then they decided what was going to happen with regard to your further training.
And how long were you there for?
Let me see. Well, we went on various assignments. For example, I went on a fortnight's appreciation flying on Tiger Moths. You know, I went back onto Tiger Moths.
So, what was the point of that?
Well, to acclimatise yourself to the geography and climate of this country, because you appreciate the difference between that and flying in the desert. Totally and utterly different.
In what way?
Well, because everything was crowded. You got fields, you got roads, canals, rivers, railways, intensive. The English countryside from the air is packed with all sorts of things and villages, and you had to obviously learn map reading, going from A to B, as against in America, you didn't have, or very few, places where there were villages or built-up areas, very few, yeah.
So, did you enjoy the course?
Oh, that's right, that was fine. That was in Birmingham. I used to call it Elmden, Birmingham Municipal Airport. That's where I went. And then returned to Harrogate again. And then I went on a commando course. Don't know why I went on that, but I did.
Tell us about that.
Oh, it was only a fortnight. It was to learn unarmed combat and things of that nature. And that was at Whitley Bay.
Now, what was the point of this
commando? I've no idea. To this day, I don't know. But it was, I think that what they were doing, they were sending us on courses just to get us out the way before we actually went on to our next stage of training.
I mean, how did you do on the ground? I mean, that's a physically intensive
course.
Oh,
it was indeed. It was indeed, yes.
And how did you cope with it?
Well, with some difficulty, I would say. It wasn't very pleasant, you know, falling into rivers and, you know, staying under canvas and things like that with teeming rain. You know, that sort of thing. We were not used to that, but you had to do it, and we did it. It was we realised it was only a passing phase, and so we went. Then we went back to Harrogate, and during the course of being in Harrogate, we were all interviewed and to decide how our career would go. And
what do you remember of this interview?
There were about four or five officers, as far as I remember, and they went into a lot of detail concerning our background with the ATC right through to the RAF, up to that particular point, having qualified as a pilot.
But what do you think they were looking for?
They were the idea was to more or less put you in the picture what they decided you were going to do as far as your career was concerned. And I think it was reckoned that I did fairly well in the flying side. Well, if I came 20th out of 107, considered above the average, and they said that I had been selected to go onto a single engine ground attack squadron flying rocket firing Typhoons, and obviously I'd have to convert onto them, and I was delighted because I aspired to be a single engine pilot more than a multi-engine bomber flying bombers.
Why? Why not a bomb, part of a team in a bomber, a Lancaster?
Yeah,
or
I don't know.
Why in a Typhoon on your own?
I just don't know. I just felt I had myself, the responsibility for myself and myself alone. And I just felt, as flying with Harvards, I was very comfortable with flying Harvards, and I felt that I could probably put up as good a show in a single-engine aircraft more than a multi-engine aircraft.
Do you think this is what the interview committee had discerned? Do you think they got that from you while they were talking to you?
It might well be. And also the fact that more or less indicated by my flying marks that I was had reached a fairly high standard from flying fighter trainers. I think that had a lot to do with it.
What about the possibilities of other single-engine aircraft? I mean, there are, you know, I mean, you could have been on the old
Spitfire.
Well, Spitfire,
Hurricanes, any of
were
them.
They still
Tempest.
I mean, the war had gone on a bit since
quite a
that.
Bit. They were being phased out on a lot of the activities. That's why Tempests and Typhoons were coming into play.
So it was no longer every boy's ambition to be a Spitfire pilot?
Well, no, not really. I mean, a lot of our people would have liked to fly on Spits, but I mean, without being derogatory, they'd be coming old hat by that time of the war. They were very underpowered in relation to Typhoons and Tempests.
Now, so where were you sent then? You'd have to have this conversion course.
That's right. But now this is where the problem started, because we're now talking about September 1944. No. Yes, about mid-September 1944, the ill-fated Arnhem operation took place. And as is generally known, this was described as the bridge too far. Related to 3 days where airborne troops were landed, and some 8 to 9 days later, only 2,500 troops were evacuated of the 10,000 troops that were landed over those 3 days.
So what effect did this have? I mean, what...
Because of this, we were told that something like 80% of the Army glider pilot regiment had been lost, either by killed, wounded or taken prisoner, largely as fighting troops, not as pilots, obviously, because they were involved in the battle as fighting troops. And a follow-up airborne operation would need to take place across the Rhine, because in the lower reach of the Rhine, it is something like 3/4 of a mile across. And therefore, a further operation was planned. But they didn't know when it could take place, the sooner the better. But in the event, they accepted they would have had insufficient time, the Army, to train replacement glider pilots. So it was decided that they would ask the Royal Air Force to release a few hundred RAF pilots from their duties to undertake glider pilot training so that the operation could continue. The pilots that were chosen obviously weren't best pleased, because they interfered with their career, and in no way did they regard themselves as soldiers. But time-honoured expression of the exigencies of the service came into play. In simple terms, that means you do as you're told.
Now, were you one of them that was selected?
Exactly, yes. And the vast majority of pilots who were at Harrogate waiting to be allocated to further training, they were cleared out, literally cleared out of Harrogate, and sent on to the glider pilot courses.
Now, how did you react to that? I mean, what did you feel?
Resentful. I think there's no way to describe it. We all felt resentful. But as time went on, we realised that in the interest of the war, we really had to undertake this training and to perform the operation which was required.
So after an initial bit of, if you like, salty,
resentment, it was,
you came round.
We came round, that is quite true, yes.
Now, where were you sent for your glider? Because I presume you had a whole course,
oh, yes,
a conversion course.
That's right. We went to Bridge North, RAF Bridge North, where we met up with the Army administration, who then began to show us what was required to become soldiers.
So you would be part of the, which regiment were you joining?
I mean, the Glider Pilot Regiment.
And that was what you, this is who you were training with?
Absolutely. And with the elements of the glider pilot regiment who had survived Arnhem or weren't actually involved in the Arnhem operation.
Now, what was your how did they take you into this? Would be would this be into still September or into October? When would this be?
Yeah, that's right. That would be in early October, not very long after the Arnhem debacle.
And what was your reception? I mean, you're RAF sergeant pilot, and
yeah.
Suddenly you're
and officers, and not only the sergeants and officers. Oh, yeah.
And now suddenly you were in the army.
That's right. We're literally in the army.
Now, what were your first impressions? How did they take you in? Were they welcoming and supportive?
Well, no, they were very welcoming and supportive. They realised we were there to help them to do a job where their own colleagues had been lost because of Arnhem. And so, there were only a smattering of army pilots, in actual fact, were with the RAF pilots.
So they weren't taking it out on you as RAF boys at all?
Oh, no, not at all, no.
Now,
no.
What about the, did you get re-equipped with new kit and uniform?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about
we had
that.
We had to have khaki uniforms as with soldiers, and we were dressed like soldiers with an RAF blue brevet. And
how did the uniform compare to the? I mean, a lot of people said the RAF uniform was better and more comfortable. How did you feel? What?
Well, the actual dress uniform of the RAF was better because but we didn't use that on a day to day basis. We used battle dress RAF with a top of trousers, and that exactly the same as with the army. They had battle dress, but theirs were khaki and ours were blue. That's the only difference. There was really no difference with the quality of material, no.
And any extra kit or any different sort of flying kit?
Well, not really. We had military equipment, webbing, which we wouldn't normally have in the RAF, and but no, not a great deal. We just carried on as with our normal equipment and uniforms that we'd had previously, other than they're a different colour. That's, I think, that's all you could really say. And then, I mean, after that, we were then sent to the conversion schools. And again...
Now, where was that at?
Well, I was sent to RAF Shobden, near Hereford.
How do you spell that, sorry?
Shobden, Shobden.
And that's near Shrewsbury?
That's near Hereford.
Sorry.
Near Hereford, yeah. And there...
That's still October.
That's right. And there I undertook a course of flying Hotspur gliders, which were small gliders, which could accommodate about six troops, quite small in actual fact, yeah.
Now, what were the skills of flying a Hotspur? I mean, how did it all work? I mean, you know,
well,
how did you get in the air? How did you control the release, the rest of it?
Yeah, well, it was you were towed into the air by masters, single engine masters, Miles masters, and then you were, once you got to a given position, you would release the tow rope yourself and then glide back to the airfield.
So what was the difference of taking off in, say, a Hotspur pulled by a master? What was the takeoff?
Well, naturally, by comparison with powered flying, totally different, because obviously you had no control. All you did was to follow the tug aircraft in front of you.
I mean, would you actually manoeuvre your flaps and things?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Fly as a normal aeroplane. The only thing, you didn't have an engine. That's all there was to it. You didn't have an engine. The power was coming from the aircraft in front.
And what was it like being towed? You know, I mean, how did it affect the feel of the aircraft in the air?
Well, only the fact that it wasn't in your control. I mean, you weren't flying in the general sense of it, other than after you released the tow rope. And then it became a normal aeroplane, but without an engine.
So The thing is, you so when you were on the end of the rope wire.
That's right.
You just basically kept station. You didn't really have much control at all.
Very little. You had to keep being normally slightly above the target aircraft. That is the.
Why was that?
Because you then weren't interfered with the airflow coming from the tug aircraft, and that could throw you about out of the place. But if you were flying in the high tow, as they called it, then it was calm air you were flying through, yeah.
And anything, so you just maintained station?
That's right, until the time come to release the tow.
Now, how did you release the tow?
Well, generally, you had a lever in the cabin, you just pull the lever and the rope then sort of flew away.
And then what was the glider like to fly then? Could you give us an idea what it was like to fly?
Well, I mean, as with any other aircraft. I mean, if you were flying a powered aircraft and you close the engine down, then you become a glider. And so one had experience in that sort of thing, flying aircraft, when you'd close the power down, and there was no difference. You had flaps, ailerons, elevators, rudders, exactly the same. You flew the aeroplane exactly the same way.
Was there a problem with risking stalling,
Well, no, you knew what your stalling speed was, and you made sure you kept above that speed.
Which you do by keeping going down?
Well, if you felt you're going to stall, then you push the nose down and therefore increase the speed. Therefore you're then much higher than the stalling speed. Yeah.
Would you have enough flying weight normally to gain height? I mean, do you see what
you
I mean?
You could do. If you dived, then you could gain sufficient speed to actually climb quite strongly at times. But then rapidly the speed would fall away. And then you'd got to push your nose down, otherwise you would go into a stall.
It was in steps, in a sense. Just the step, you could go down and then up a bit, and then you'd have to go back down again.
If you wish to, yeah, it's quite true. Yeah.
How long could you fly?
Well, it depends on how far you were from the airfield and how high you were above the ground when you were released. You could, if you had what we call a remote release, you could be released about 7 miles away from the airfield at several thousand feet, yet still get back to the airfield and get into the circuit and land properly. You could do that. But again, we were highly trained pilots, and obviously it was easy to us.
Were gliders less forgiving in the sense that you didn't have an engine to switch on if you made a mistake? All you could do is point the nose down to get more speed.
Well, yeah, the less forgiving is to the extent that there's no way you're going to go around again if you made a mistake with powered aircraft. You were going down, and you would go down if you made a mistake. If you undershot or overshot, you'd obviously pay the penalty for that. But that's where the skill was of flying. You didn't allow that to happen. You made sure that you actually landed in the place you intended to land at.
And first time.
Absolutely.
And your first flight, I mean, did they take you up with dual control at first and then move to single?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You had a couple of circuits with the instructor, and then we're on our own after that.
Did you practice much? Because it just seems that landing might have been quite a dangerous affair. How often would you practice landing?
Well, most days. Most days would.
And mostly you'd land without damage to the...
Oh, yeah, they had a sort of a skid underneath the actual... These hotspurs had like a skid and more than wheels, yeah.
So you didn't actually damage... You didn't damage the glider and land it at
all? No, not at all, no. And that was the early part of it. And then...